As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Shelley, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, good to have you on. Remind me, I think I had you on a year ago, the last time. I know the time before that was like 2 years ago. So I'm trying to like keep track of.
I think originally it was 2020 that we spoke. Okay. It was like November or something of 2020. And then, yes, I believe last year was the last time we were on. Gotcha. I was on with John. Yeah.
Third time's the charm.
So, yeah, right?
Yeah. So I know for anybody who's listening, they've probably have heard your story, but it was 2020. So if they haven't heard it, they can go back and kind of get a refresher. But if you're giving the elevator pitch of your life, if you're giving like the 2 minute, here's what people should know for context, what would you say?
Yeah. So I was born and raised in the IFB, the Independent Fundamental Baptists. And I basically went as a missionary overseas, kind of under them. That's kind of a weird mix because my husband is Romanian, and so we were over there for a while in his home country, and so there was a clean break and a realization there that I was like raised in a really different way. I came to start calling it a cult, and then in 2020 it was the first time I was public about that story. And you know, I had been an author, a novelist for a few years already, but there was something in the air, I guess, that made me feel like, oh my gosh, this is the story that I've been suppressing almost, you know, waiting to tell. Right. And I think it was, honestly, Eric, when I found your podcast and I realized how young you are, I was like, oh, it's like still around. You know, I think it was kind of like out of sight, out of mind. Clearly in the information age, this can't be happening, which is also pretty cool to watch your story. Like you saw things and you started asking questions and you were able to do the research. I was not, you know? And so, it just really encouraged me to come on, tell my story, and then start speaking publicly about my experiences, and it really informed the rest of my work, or my continued work, I should say, like what I'm doing currently.
Right. Yeah. It's so weird, 'cause like, it's the inverse experience that I had, which was because I'm young, like, and was able to Google things. It's like, I was piecing together so much of this stuff. And then I would see people who 10 years before, 20 years before, 30 years before, I mean, some like in the 60s, you know, like, yeah. And you'd go back and go, oh, this has been happening for a long time. So like, I talk to people who go, oh, I saw with you, it's still happening. And then I'm like, oh, it has been happening for a really long time. And like you said, the ability to one share stories was so limited just a couple of years ago. I mean, 15 years ago, 20 years ago was so limited. And then the ability to actually research these guys and put pieces together was really, really tricky.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, an interesting tidbit is that, so I met my husband at Hiles Anderson, and it was 1993. And we had in the handbook that there was a banned book. So if you grew up IFB, you know that, like,
right,
you signed things all the time, or you read, you know, like the rules were second nature almost, right? So I signed my name to that handbook. I skimmed it. My husband read it. He was not raised IFB, right?
Yeah.
And he went to the public library and checked out that book, and it was Fundamental to Seduction.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so he read it and he was like, this place is crazy. And ultimately ended up leaving, and, you know, I married him and left as well. But, you know, that's that access to that small piece of information is really what led to me years, you know, many years later of understanding what I was raised in. Right. But it didn't come to light for me because I didn't have access to it. He had a car. Girls weren't allowed to leave campus.
Right. Know? Right. Someone posted that recently, that it's still a written rule in the rule book that like girls are not supposed to have cars. And like, if they do, there's like so many stipulations and like weird rules about it. I'm curious for you, like you've had, I think you probably feel like me in terms of like, you've got a story within that world, but like you see some of the like crazy extreme stories and probably go like, well, mine wasn't as bad as theirs, but it was pretty crazy. Did you take any thought into, oh, let me write my story verbatim? Like, let me just go nonfiction. Here's kind of my experience in this. Or was it always like, hey, I want to tackle this from a fictional kind of angle?
So I actually started writing a memoir in 2018. So that I knew that the story was in me and that like I needed to do something with it. And then I read the book Educated by Tara Westover. Have you read that?
No, it's been recommended like 60 times.
Yes,
and I haven't read it yet.
It's heavy. So for me, it was so good. Like, she's an exquisite writer, and just reading it was a pleasure. But at the same time, it's very heavy. And I have some similar experiences in that, not that I was like raised in a mountain, you know, hidden from actual culture, but her escape was singing. And so that was something that I was always involved in. And I was angry that the church or the IFB used that talent of mine for their benefit, instead of having it be my escape. So I found that it was just so emotional for me. And so when I read that book, it just made me feel like I'm not ready to tell my story. I'm so, so engrossed in the crap of it, that I want to be able to be a little bit more on the peaceful side to write that memoir. And it may still happen. I actually, next month, I have a chapter in an anthology. I was invited to be part of an anthology of women making a difference in business and in their communities. So, you know, because I speak out and do work on advocating and activism, I was invited to write part of my story. And so I have a chapter in that book that is basically, I took a lot of it from the start of my like four chapters that I wrote of my memoir. So yeah, maybe it'll be a full book one day. We'll see. But I do love my fiction.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like that's kind of your escape, like versus music or all the other dance, all the other things that people mention. It seems like writing has kind of been that for you. I'm curious, like I've sat down to write before. I've started a couple different, like this could be a book, you know, and one of the things that I realized is that whether talking on the podcast or writing, like the more that you talk about your experience, the more you learn about it and you realize like when you have to do a timeline of something or when you have to write about what you were feeling at that time, you put yourself back in those shoes or those culottes in your case. When you put yourself back in that experience, you start seeing like, oh, this was worse than I remembered, or this was different than I remembered at least, or I forgot that this even happened. It seemed so small at the time. What's maybe one or two things that before you put pen to paper or fingers to keyboard, like that you just didn't recognize as being harmful or even just frustrating or odd to you at the time? There's probably 10,000 things, but two or three.
Right. Two or three. So I don't know that. I think that everything could be beneficial, right? So whatever phase you're in, whatever you're gravitating toward, that may just be the time that you need to experience it. And to write about it is always helpful. It might not always be a book though. And I think that starting a book proposal is a great idea. I actually work with clients and that's what I tell them. Whether you're going to hybrid publish, self-publish, seek a traditional publisher, start by doing the research of how to do a good book proposal, because then you'll know if you have like the content for that. And you'll also start to work through all of those feelings, especially if it's nonfiction, you know, if it's this like specifically memoir, you know, that we're speaking of telling your own story, right? You have to be able to work through that to get it in a position to where it's going to be readable to people. Cause like I said, reading Tara Westover's novel showed me that I was in a position of the muck still, and that my writing wasn't ready for the public. And so that can really happen. And that's another thing, read, write, repeat, like just do it. Just read and write and read and write and read and write. You don't have to read full books. If you don't like a book, leave it alone, abandon it. But like,
thank you.
Yeah.
You're welcome, right? I hate that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I hate that. My mom always will like power through books and she'll be like, it's horrible. She'll be in like chapter 4 and I'm like, you know, it's not an assignment. Like you can put this book down. You can burn this book. It's fine. You can do whatever you want to do. But she's like always like I'm pushing through. Even back when I was a kid, it was be like this Russian novel. It's like 1,000 pages. And I'm like, you do not have to do this to yourself. No. And so I love that idea, especially with like self-help type books.
Yeah.
Like there's tons of times I'll read like the 3 chapters that look tailor-made for me and I'll leave the rest. So thank you for saying that.
Yeah, of course. Like
give I that just, permission often.
Yes, please. Just like use what works for you. And I think that with that mentality, it was easier for me to kind of let go of some of the things. Like I've grown to appreciate the fact that being raised in such a strict environment, I have never struggled with addiction. Hmm. You know, I wasn't exposed to it. Maybe it was because, you know, I was scared to go and get in trouble even after I was like, I don't think that's true. You know, but like there are things that I'm like, oh, that probably protected me and my personality type. So that's a good thing that I can see out of it. And I just feel that way about life. Like take the good from it and leave what doesn't work for you. Mm. Like, and I do usually commit to about the first 50 pages in a book to see, because sometimes it gets better. But yeah, I leave it when I just, you know, I'm like, oh, this is not for me.
Right. Right. Exactly. I'm curious, like drilling down a little bit into your experience and like digging into it in the book format. Like you mentioned some things can be positive or something. Like, was there anything that surprised you where like maybe you thought it was something that affected you negatively worse than it did, or something that like seemed like, oh, this would be the thing people would think was super traumatic or hard to deal with, but it was a blip on my radar, you know? Cause I feel like I asked that because I feel like I have a lot of things like that where I'll share something and I'll be like, yeah, oh, this happened. And people go, oh my God. And then I'll like talk about something that people just kind of brush over. And like, to me, it was super heavy. So I'm curious, was there anything that was like that where it was like, this is what people would probably think would be a chapter, but it was kind of nothing to me.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So I will go a little bit into my backstory. And if you listen to my other interview, you'll know that I have child sexual abuse in my story. And so I say this with caution because I feel like it lands on everyone different ways, but I have very vague memories of the experience, but very vivid memories of how the church handled it. And so the trauma, even in therapy that I have gone through, like the deepest levels, have been not by the perpetrator of the sexual abuse, but actually about the ideologies that I internalized because of the way I was taught. And so that is very like surprising to some people. You know, as you know, my brother and I have the same experience, the same abuser, and his is actually probably parallel, like the same damage that was, you know, so things, yeah, manifest themselves in different ways for different people. And also I remember once telling somebody, this is like less dramatic than the, you know, abuse, but I was telling somebody about this youth conference when I was a teenager that, you know, the theme was mob, like the mob. And Jack Hiles was like carrying guns and everybody was like dressed as mob people. And they were like, what? You know, like literally. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm pretty sure. So I like got on the internet to find it, to prove that I was right. Cause I was like, this is kind of unbelievable. Now that you step back and you think about it, like they were literally telling us that they he was like the boss, the mob boss, and controlling everything. And yeah, so yeah, experiences like that of just the way that we were portrayed to me seemed normal. And flippantly, I'll talk about it, and people will be like, could you say that again?
Right. Yeah. No, and the first thing you said really checks out with so many people I've talked to where like the abuse is obviously traumatic and that's enough, you know, that's enough trauma, but then it's the trauma of the legal process. It's the trauma of the religious reaction. It's the trauma of how the first people you talk to deal with it. And so there's layers and layers and layers on top of it. And even even recently I've talked to people who like just the trauma of never getting closure, you know, like the trauma of, you know, the statute of limitations or of the abuser passed away before something could happen or all these different one person I was talking to recently was sharing and I'd never even thought about this happening, but it's probably happened to more than I can think of. But she was saying she remembers being abused as a little kid, but doesn't even know who it was. And like the stuff tied into that, I mean, there's that feeling of not knowing or not being able to do anything about it. And really what her take was, which I think is really cool tying to this conversation, was that you kind of live vicariously seeing other people's stories and knowing that you're not alone and seeing that some people are seeing justice. And obviously it doesn't replace yours, but they were saying like how cathartic it was seeing other people actually put their abusers behind bars or find healing. So
yeah, that's definitely my experience too. And when the filming, when I watched the Let Us Pray documentary that you and, you know, those incredible women did, I was so, I don't know, I had that same sentiment, right? Of like, yes, justice for them is justice for all. Like really, truly, that's how it felt. Because there are so many of us, like that's my experience as well. I did not remember who the abuser was until my brother actually shared who it was. And, you know, like then I did some research and everything. I was like, oh, okay, yeah. But like, I was so young, I didn't remember, you know, the actual person. And so to see those women come forward with, you know, some sort of justice, and we all wish it was more, right? But like it did, it really felt like, yes, that is for us all. Thank you.
Hey, everybody, we're going to get back to the show in just a minute. But first, I want to let you know that this episode's sponsor is Factor. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. You can choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. I picked the keto option, and I have to say I have tried a ton of different meal prep services, and while I've liked some of them, this is without a doubt the best meal prep service that I have used to date. And I'm saying that 100% honestly. They didn't write that in a script for me to say. I'm telling you from my very own experience. I actually just ate, before recording this ad, the jalapeno lime cheddar chicken with spicy cilantro cauliflower rice, and it was absolutely incredible. But I want you to try it for yourself. You can get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals. It eliminates the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up, all things that I absolutely hate doing, and all you have to do is heat and savor the good stuff. It is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. And Factor is also incredible because they're doing something special for my audience. You can head over to factormeals.com/preacherboys50 and use code preacherboys50 at checkout to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code preacherboys50 at factormeals.com/preacherboys50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. All right, let's get back to the show.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Right. Yeah. And I'm sure people will feel that way, like listening to your story, reading through your book, like all these things that are being done. I mean, you're doing live talks, you know, sharing your story and things like that. Like in this book specifically that you have coming out at the end of April, give us a little bit of context without spoiling the book. Like, what can people expect to see represented in the book? Like, is it going to be a lot of elements that are kind of your story, but not really? Is it going to be a kind of collection of other experiences you've heard about or that you've seen happen within fundamentalist circles? What's kind of the 10,000 foot view of the book?
Yeah. So the book is called The Cheating Wife. It is not a personal narrative. So I'd like to say that.
Good to clear up when you give the title to go, this is not about me. This is not a self-report.
Oh my gosh. Yes. So I, you know, came to my husband actually, and I was like, here's the idea that I have, and this is what I want to do. And he was like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. But maybe put by Shelley Snowboardia on this one instead of just like the title and then your name at the bottom.
Yeah. A colon is not a good one for that. Yeah.
Right. So The Cheating Wife is based on an experience that my husband and I actually witnessed. We saw the defacing of somebody's property with the words cheating wife on it. And it, of course, sparked a lot of conversation in our home, in our friend group. And I just was like, is she safe? Is anyone checking on her? Is this the, you know, 2023 version of the Scarlet Letter?
Yeah.
And so from that, I created a story about a woman who has been suffering abuse. And she, like, the church plays a role in it, because, you know, I live in the Bible Belt, I live in the Midwest. And so, like, this idea that we treat women poorly, if we even assume that they are cheaters, and yet men almost every time get a pass, still is something I want to challenge. I want to say, like, hey, be better, do better. Mm-hmm. You know, this, we have an opportunity to grow and not be like we're in the 1800s, because literally that's how it felt. Like, she's in our community and now she's brandished with this, you know, in our case, blue letters. Yeah. So, and I do draw a lot from the experience that I had working in a church, and, you know, just being, you know, friends with certain people who had experiences of being in abusive relationships. And though I have a lot of heavy themes in it, I think that it's an uplifting book. Yeah, I'm a Jane Austen fan, so if that tells you anything, like, everyone has a happy ending.
Right. Do you find writing in that way and giving the happy ending, do you have a optimistic look at reality, or do you just have an optimistic hopefulness when writing fictionally? Because I've become far more pessimistic over the, I feel like, over the last year. And I'm curious if your writing is a reflection of how you feel about reality, or if it's a, I wish it was like this kind of approach.
Yeah. So I can't say that justice is actually served, but in my, you know, writing, but I think an emergence of triumphant women is what I have experienced in my life. So it's really what I wanted to write about. You know, it might look different for different people. You know, you might categorize it as the, you know, different than I would in my book, but that's, you know, how I see it, that I have been proven, or it's been proven to me time and time again, that the women who have been abused and have suffered the most, that I know personally, are the most resilient and have come out on top. And I want people to see that. I want women to find themselves in this story if they've ever been abused or hurt or unseen even. I'd like people who are in the church to recognize that sometimes good people do bad things and that they can do better. I hope that they see the, I have a woman in the book, a character who is, you know, still very involved in her church community, and she sees it and does something about it. So I want that to be a message. Yeah, I don't know who's going to pick up the book or the story, but I really feel like the message, especially nowadays, you know, I'm not looking to change the world. I feel like really triggered by that. You know?
Yeah.
But I am, I think it's important for us to share the nuance of story. And so whoever does pick up the book, I hope they can see the truth in the fiction. I forget who it was who said, it was an old classic fiction writer, but whoever it was, they said, we write fiction to tell the truth we are unable to utter. So I think that's
Googling who wrote
yes. it. Yes. Yeah. I might have botched it a little, so something to that effect. But yeah.
Joshua Halberstam?
Sure.
Wendell Berry?
I don't know. Don't put it on like it's Instagram one of those quotes as that, a meme.
It's one of those quotes that everybody says. Yeah. Neil Gaiman. Fiction's the lie that tells the truth.
There you go.
Pick one. Pick a name.
Pick one.
Shelley Snow Cordia said it on the Preacher Boys podcast. I love that perspective shift too. Cause like I said, I'm a pretty optimistic person in general. And I would say I'm as pessimistic as I've gotten. I'm still more optimistic than most people, but it is, I think the way you just described it in terms of when you think in the macro of saving the world, it's easy to just want to crawl into a hole and die. At least that's my experience.
Same.
You know, when you think about the individual victories or the, you know, or even in terms of not necessarily victory in a legal setting or victory in a case or victory in a fill in the blank, but you're looking at just the development of a person or the rising of a person from, you know, captivity essentially to kind of liberation. Like, there's a lot of really cool, beautiful stories. And so I like that perspective shift, because I think for me, especially lately, you know, you're seeing not only people get screwed by the church religious system, but then it's their family, and then it's the legal system where it's 4 years to get, you know, they spend more time in court than their abuser spends in jail or even on probation. And it's like, I think when you start looking at those bigger pictures, it's easy to just sit there and go, well, everything sucks, and like, this is not going to get better anytime soon. But yeah. I do think what you mentioned is like, when I think of the hope for the people sitting in the pew who are tentative about staying, when you think about the people who are, you know, starting to really explore for themselves for the first time, like, that's a really cool world that is developing a lot of really cool stories, and it's easy to lose sight of it. And so I appreciate you sharing that perspective shift, because I think it's needed. And I think for those of us trying to battle cynicism, it's a good thing to keep in mind.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm the same way. You know, I watched a documentary yesterday and I'm like, well, you know what? The world is screwed. Everything is like not what it seems, you know? So there are those realities. But at the same time, the most resilient women I know have come from abuse, from, you know, the IFB, and have emerged with college degrees, which is a major accomplishment. Yeah. They have careers of their own, and they have even been able to buy, you know, a house and support their children. And so, like, that to me is victorious. And I think we can celebrate it. Right. And what is justice? I don't know what that looks like, to be honest, right? What would repair, you know? And I can't answer that. I don't even know what it would look like in my own life, much less in someone else's. And so to focus on the victories is really important for me.
Yeah. It is a question always of like, what is enough? And it I don't think there's anything that can grant you enough, you know, like, it's something that is affecting you for life. Like, it is something that does severe damage. So like, will any ruling or any exposure make it better? I don't think necessarily, but I think those internal developments are huge. And it is, I mean, abuse or anything that violates you from the outside is a difficult thing, because, you know, you can't really try to think of how to word it, but like, for an individual thing, like, say you make a bad financial decision and you bounce back from it, like, that's something you caused that you get to fix. Or if you want a further education, like, that's something that maybe you didn't really pursue it or take it seriously. Now you can change it. But it's like, when there's something that's stolen from you, or when you're abused, or when somebody does something to you, like, they're not going to be proactive in helping you recover from that. Like, two people, like, or one person really put this on you, and then you, in this rare situation, have it on yourself to rebuild from it. And that's a really interesting perspective to be approaching life from. I'm curious, like, you're focused so much on the positive things and like the things that can be controlled. Like, where do you find the balance, both in your life and in your writing, of not minimizing your own experiences while also reclaiming your life? So you're not living in a reactionary state to, oh, this happened to me, so now I am Shelly Snow Pardia, the victim, or Shelly Snow Pardia, like, I am defined by this bad thing, and instead can go, that happened, and now this. Like, where do you find that balance without downplaying and also having a life that is your own?
Yeah, that's a great question. For me, I have actually spent a lot of time thinking about that, because I embrace the word victim as something that helps me identify what happened to me. I also embrace, you know, other aspects of my own identity. And so I look at an identity not as a label, but as a mosaic. And I piece those things together for the picture of my own life. And I heard in, a metaphor once about a box of Legos, right? That's what our life is like. It's basically, we are essentially these pieces and we can configure them in any way we imagine. And we don't always stay that way. We, you know, break them down and rebuild. And I think that really just helped me kind of visualize this mosaic of my own. And I don't have to shy away from feeling like a victim at the times that I am maybe rehashing that story, because I was victimized. And so what else? I think actually in my book, I have a, you know, this conversation with the protagonist where she's saying, why can't I say victim? Because somebody victimized me. Like, stop telling me not to act the victim because I was hurt. And, you know, in the moment, that's how she felt. That's how I have felt. And so I can use that term and be like, I was a victim. And also, I am triumphant. I have overcome. I am, what's the survivor? You know, that's another one that's kind of labeled as, you know, be somebody who thrives, not someone who survived. I'm like, I can actually do both. We build this picture of our lives. And once we start piecemealing it out of like, I am labeled as this, I have to be X, Y, or Z, that to me seems a little too holdy.
You know? Yeah. You're not defined by just one experience. Like, there's multiple pieces. I feel like life is like a box of Legos that someone poured on the floor and you're just stepping on them constantly. that's been my experience. I love that mosaic example, because I this is something, and it's so funny talking to you, because I feel like there's so many things you're saying that have been just on my mind lately. And one of those is just like, I hadn't thought of it in terms of a mosaic example, but like, there are many things that are true and there's many experiences. And like, I think that was kind of with my last question I really wanted to hit on, is that I think some people feel forced to be one thing, or feel forced to be expressing one type of process for living. You know, like for people who leave religion, it's like, well, now you can't be spiritual in any regard. Or when people leave a relationship, it's like, well, now you can never be in close proximity to anybody. Or like, there's so many things that get just, that's the label now, and that's now your identity. Versus like, there's many different things that make up you as a person, and you are a collection of your experiences in many ways. But I also love the thought that you don't have to end any of these chapters. Like, you can spend time re-examining and going through things that have happened and exploring how that affected you, because the older you get and the more experiences you have, the more context you have for those experiences. And so I've found, for me, the podcast has been the, and I can't think of a better word than box. And I've said this a couple of times, and I always go back to box, which is such a negative connotation when talking about this stuff. But to me, it's like, it's the box that I like, I'm going to go open this box and talk about religious trauma. And then when I'm done, I close that box and go do all the, like, I open all the other boxes of, you know, things that I am. And for you, do you feel like writing has been the box in which you deal with this? And then do you feel like there's a hum of religious trauma that's always there? Or do you feel like it's something now at this point in your journey, you go, I deal with it in the way I want to, I control it in this area, and then I put that box away and I have my life, I'm Shelley, and everywhere else. Like, how do you feel like it plays a part in your existence now?
Yeah. I mean, you ask the easiest questions, Eric. Why don't you just throw me a curveball?
Is that sarcasm or is that? I always laugh when I'm like, I have one last question that I'm like, tell me about this thing that's like 20 years of therapy. Yeah, let's do that.
Exactly. Yes. That's how I feel. Okay. So you used a word that really resonates with me, and you asked if there was a hum. And so I have a background as a singer, and I rejoined an a cappella chorus last year.
Hey, Fundy approved. Way to go.
Right? Except so not. The first night we sang Freddie Mercury, and I was like, I could do this. So
you're going more pitch perfect than Hiles Anderson.
It literally is pitch perfect, trust me. Okay, so when I went into that situation, I realized the religious trauma was with me. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it is always there, and it just depends on when that, you know, hum is going to, you know, come into the forefront and, you know, trigger you. Because we are such nuanced creatures, and dealing with it. Yes, I have a writing practice, and so I do not write about religious trauma all the time. Right. I write for fun. I write just to keep up my habits, and I read a lot. I can't always read religious trauma, right? So I try to have that balance there. I feel like for me, I'm very intentional with the conversation. So when I, you know, started to reach out and say, hey, I've got this new book coming, I'm speaking about these certain topics, and, you know, I just schedule that into my life to where it's not overwhelming for me. Right. Because when I'm too deep into it, then I just get burnt out. I mean, I'm sure I don't have to tell you this, right? Yeah. But even if I try to box it up pretty, like I said, so, you know, things will come up, and I had to leave the risers like recently when I've been in this chorus for over a year, and we sing mostly secular songs, and there was a trigger moment for me. And I was like, oh, this is bringing up a lot of stuff. I have to leave. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, you know, I am open about my story. And so like, I had already had the discussion with my choral director that like, hey, this is my background. If I'm triggered, it's definitely not you. It's a me thing. We can talk through some of those triggers and how to best mitigate, like, you know, having me come in as a newbie and not be completely overwhelmed that I'm not in your cult, you know?
Yeah, right.
So, but I find that I do find it often that is a steady hum in my life. And I don't know that it will be different. Maybe it will someday.
Yeah. 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 It's just been on my mind a lot. Like, and that's where, you know, that's why I like doing the show, because I get to ask questions that are for me, you know, like it's something I know for a long time. I would wake up a lot of days, even recent, I mean, as like 2020, like I would wake up and just feel like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened. Or, oh, I can't believe that that experience took place. And like, it's been very recently, like the last year, and you know, I'm bad with time. So probably the last year and a half, like I've really felt like I have, like it's, that hum's been largely gone the more that I've had a process to deal with it. And I think that's kind of where you mitigate a lot of triggers. And I even use triggers lightly when I talk about things, because like there's a huge difference between uncomfortable and like, oh, I can't even be in this room right now. But for me, it's dealing with it on my own terms has meant everything, you know, like being able to say, here's my process and my method, much like writing for you, being able to say, okay, for the time I'm sitting down on this microphone, like this is my time to deal with this.
Yes.
And it gets rid of the, you know, again, that reactionary life of like, oh, this thing just surprised me. And I feel like the more you can get rid of the surprises, like the more easy, for lack of a better word, because life's not easy, but the easier it gets to deal with life and to get through it every day without going, okay, there's constantly just these jack-in-the-boxes that are about to spring open every 2 seconds, you know, which is horrifying. But also, I mean, the surprises still happen, as healed as you get. I mean, I mentioned a while back on my newsletter, but like I was at a retreat with other people and super relaxed, probably the most at peace with life I'd been like in a long time. And then I was leaving the retreat. I'm in the airport and I see a pastor who was at all the conferences that we went to growing up. And I instantly, like, palms are sweaty. Like I feel like truly triggered. Like, and I never use that word for myself ever. Like I truly felt like, oh my God, like my heart's racing. I don't even want to be in this airport. And it was a good reminder that, like, as much as you have healed, it's still there. And it was just a reconfirmation of, like, okay, dealing with it on my own terms has been a very healthy practice. Cause here's what happens when you're in the wild. Like, here's the thing that happens when you're surprised. And so it was just a reminder, like, you're healed, but also there's some old wounds that are going to be there and you have to learn ways to process it. And the more you heal, the less time there is between the trigger and, like, the back to normal. Like, that reset period gets shorter at least, which, I mean, that's speaking to where I'm at now. So maybe in 2 years I'll have a different response, but.
Well, do you think that, you know, kind of reframing it into what is happening in the moment, like, has been what has allowed you to do it? Like, well, first of all, what did you do? Did you do anything? Did you say hello? Did they see you? I want to know, in the airport.
I ate a burrito from Starbucks and I shakily poured sriracha onto it and just ate my emotions. There you go. You're asking me questions now. No, for me, it was really, I feel like what's been helpful for me has been telling the truth about the situation. Like, and it does not look beautiful. Like, that sounds very, like, you know, it's like, here we go. For me in that moment, it was literally just, yes, shakily pouring sriracha on a breakfast burrito. Cause I'm going to eat those every time. But for me, it was just literally telling myself internally, like, he has absolutely no control over anything in your life today. Like, he doesn't even recognize you. First of all, like, you were a person in a group of 2,000 people that was watching him scream on stage. And beyond that, like, even if he does, or even if he saw you, or even if he hates you, and even if he's seen the Preacher Boys podcast, like, and was mad about it an hour before he was in the airport, and he does definitely know who I am, like, what's he going to do about it? Like, tweet about it? You know, like, it was such a, like, oh, it's not like he's going to call my pastor, you know, like, there was nothing there that was, like, tethered to the reality I'm living now. Yeah. And that's kind of the whole, when the body keeps the score thing, right? It's like,
yes,
you can see someone in it, the same red jacket that the person who assaulted you wore, and your body, to protect you, is going to say, there's that red jacket. Yeah. But the way to overcome that is to tell yourself, that's a different person who happens to be wearing the same jacket. And I think just telling yourself the truth about, here's where I am now, makes all the difference. Or, you know, extrapolating that for someone who's listening, like, you know, when something feels heavy and you think, oh, my parents feel this way about me, it's like, do your parents have the same control? Like, does your pastor have the same, like, does that person on the internet who you don't know, who just happens to be in the same religious group, have the same control?
Yeah.
And the answer is either yes, and, like, how do I reclaim that control? Or more often, no, and I just need to remind myself that I've got the control now. And, like, that's the opposite of the reactionary kind of living that really grinds my gears, like, when I see people living in a reactionary way, because it's not the best way to live. Like, if every action you do is just an opposite reaction to what's expected of you from this religious group, like, that's not living either. It's like, what do I want for my life and how do I pursue that?
Yeah. How do you think you got to that place? So for me, I remember that the biggest, like, devastation, it was probably, like, that, you know, last little click of that latch that just untethered me from everything.
Another good metaphor. bring a writer on and, like, see how many metaphors you get. Yeah. Later.
Right. But I realized I could trust myself. And that felt like a huge, huge, huge betrayal, because I was like, oh, I can trust myself in the moment to, like, do the simplest things, like you're talking about, Eric, like saying, oh, that's a different person. That is, I'm not in that situation. That person isn't in control. You know, so that takes a level of trust in myself that I did not have for decades. And that was huge for me. So I was just wondering, like, for you, what was that allowed you to say, oh, I can trust that I know better in this circumstance?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to throw another metaphor onto our, but why not? Let's stack them up. at least one of these will, someone will be like, oh, that makes sense. but I think as you were saying that and saying trusting yourself, like, I mean, going back to writing, I mean, you're taught from an early age that you're an unreliable narrator, you know, like you're taught that, especially as a woman in the IFB, like, you're taught like you're a deceiver, like you're a descendant of Eve. Like you are the most unreliable of narrators, you know, but even for me, like I believe that I was unreliable in terms of I needed to verify what I was feeling with the leadership that I did trust, because I trusted the leadership more than myself. And that's a common experience of whether you're in NXIVM or Scientology or the IFB or Mormonism or fill in the blank. That seems to be a common experience of, I ran all of my thoughts through somebody. And I don't think there's like a, here's the really sexy system I use now to like overcome that. I think it's just a passage of time. And again, constantly having conversations with yourself again to confirm what's true. And that's not to go down a big rabbit hole, but like that was kind of the big breaking point for me with the IFB is like, once I realized they were lying about how they dealt with abuse, to me, it was a clear line in the sand moment of like, if they're not telling the truth about this, the most important thing, how do I take their word for anything else? And it wasn't as, I mean, that sounds easy to say now, you know, like versus 2011, where like I'm figuring all that stuff out. Right. But it's one of those things where over time, I'm looking at my life and going, oh, they lied about this. They lied about that. And the thing that they said would happen to me has not happened. The things that they said I would become, I have not become. My friend and I talk about this all the time of like, you know, you hear the stories of you leave the church and your marriage falls apart and your this happens, you get addicted to drugs and all the like blah, 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 all those things. And then we look at our lives and we're like, we've been married almost 10 years now and we're good parents and, you know, like we do drink and drinking can be great in moderation and, you know, all these sorts of things. And like that slippery slope just doesn't exist in the way that we were so terrified of it existing. And again, it's like the journey for me out from 2011, when that spark was lit or the crack began or whatever metaphor you want to use there, to now has just been just constant research and confirmation of they were building a house of cards. There's another metaphor. Good God. Yeah. but they were built on this that wasn't based in reality. I'm living my life and seeing things that are both good and negative for me that I'm seeing through experience. Like, but ultimately it's like, what is truth? And I think the minute you start taking truth for granted and you're not investigating it, both in what you're telling yourself and what others are telling you, I think the more you can get through that process, like the better place you're going to be, you know, because we tell ourselves bullshit all the time too. Like there's plenty to examine in our own experiences, but that can be as simple as what I was saying about the airport. Like I was sitting there and that underlying thing was going, oh my God, he's way above me. Mm-hmm. Oh, he's this big, powerful leader. The guy's a nobody to anybody outside that world. And I'm not outside, you know, like I'm not in that world anymore. So like, why am I letting that emotion control me instead of reclaiming the truth, which is I run my life and I operate my life and people like me, and I'm not this person that I'm worried they think I am, you know. It's constantly just going, what is the truth, and giving yourself honest answers and also being okay with the fact that sometimes you are the problem in a case, or you are the person who is being crazy in this moment. Like, but what is the objective truth of the situation? You know, what is the thing that is not rooted in just flat out lies about, you know, who you are or who another person is, or, you know, fill in the blank. But there's 10 minutes. Here's 10 minutes for anybody who wanted a 10 minute interview of me. That was a very fulfilling section for them.
No, I think it's good. It's important to hear from you and like how it plays out too in your life, because who would have thought? Like, I have always been an investigator, right? Yeah. I've always wanted to know things, read things, learn things. And until I really started to collect my own evidence, I didn't see it, right? Mm. I was buying what they were selling, or, you know, or trying to convince myself that the experience that I was living was not matching up to what they were telling me because I was wrong.
Yeah.
Right. So to take that leap and to really, or just, I guess it's not even a leap. It's kind of baby steps, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
Where you just like, oh, well, that's different. And you give yourself permission to start collecting evidence and living off of your own evidence. And honestly, Eric, it's like you use that phrase of like, you know, investigating truth. In our world, when we were growing up, there was truth and lies. There wasn't like nuance to truth. Like, yeah. Can this be true and this be true and that be true? And yes, like they can all be true. But we were never, ever, ever given that experience of critical thinking to where more than one thing can be true.
Right. Yeah. Well, it wasn't even buying what they're selling. I mean, for both of our experiences, like we were kids. So like it was truth. Like the lies were truth.
Right.
You know, like it was the sky is blue. I say this all the time. I need to come up with new things. I feel like I feel like a comedian now where it's like, I have to come up with a new joke for this because people are going to get tired of it, but it's true. So I'm going to keep saying it, but like this, it was the sky is blue, like grass is green. 1 + 1 = 2. And then here's all this rigorous theology, like from the time you're a little kid. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite literally hardwired, you know, it's that hum of that operating system that you had installed. And so like, it wasn't like you sat there. I envy people who say like, oh, I joined a cult at 20. And I'm like, well, that's a lot of work to deal with. But like, what do you do if you grew up in this? And what do you do if you didn't ever make a choice? Like, at least you picked your poison in some way. Like, like, what do you do when like your mind idles and you instantly revert back to what you were raised in? Like, it's a mess, but it is learning that skill of investigation and being able to go, okay, that was not the only option. I was told it was for 20 years, but there's all these other things. And so I think that's a really valuable process to learn. And I think that's like, if I was to write a book, and I definitely feel like that's something I want to do, you know, sometime soon.
I hope so.
Like, I really want to focus in on that kind of mindset of not just having the reactionary, because I always go back to the default fundamentalist conversation. Like, people tend to go, I left this group, now I'm all in on this, without critically thinking through it. And so I'd really love to write something that examines like why we tend to be drawn to the black and white, and why we are default fundamentalists, and why, you know, living in direct contrast to whatever you grew up in is not freedom. Like, you're still living in service of that system. And I think that the thing that we need to develop is not necessarily how we agree with a system 100%, but like, what is our process for receiving information, processing it, and then applying information? And I feel like that's a skill that was never taught to us. And it's like the number one skill I think everyone needs to learn, especially those that are healing from a toxic system. There's a lot of work to be done in that area, but it's why I like having these conversations too. Cause I feel like you're saying so many things that I'm like, well, I'm thinking that like there's some truth to this being some part of the process, you know?
Sorry, my dog.
It's okay. Editing.
Yeah. I mean, I feel the same way, and it's really fascinating that you say that. And I hope that you do write this book, because education has been key for me, like access to information. And I know that we live in this just crazy world of, you know, bombardment of information, and it's hard to decipher the reality from, you know, what is made up. But
Algorithm.
Yeah. Or what is algorithm? Yeah. Right. Oh my gosh. Like, seriously, I can't battle.
Talk about a fuel for modern fundamentalism when you've got an algorithm, confirming constantly that your ideology is the way. and not seeing any counterpoints, but
yeah,
I'll save that for the book.
Right. But yes, do that.
I'm glad I told a writing coach that I'm thinking about writing a book, because I know I'm definitely in some email funnel now, but
hey, I do not unethically add anyone to my email list. So if you didn't sign up for it, you're not getting it.
So. Let me say this, but just before we say anything else, if I email somebody, my biggest pet peeve in the world is when I've emailed people, one, just random people who I've emailed with to like answer a question, or they've emailed me, we've corresponded, and then I start getting their email because they just think like now we're tight, I guess.
Yeah.
My biggest pet peeve ever is when I've pitched guests, and this has happened a few times, I've pitched guests to come on my show and they've declined coming on the show, but added me to their email list. That is like, if you do that, you're dead to me. And I've literally had people that I've pitched that have done that, where like, I think now I could get them, but out of spite, I will never have them on the show because like it drives me so crazy. And it happens all the time. Like even just people
like, not legal, correct? Because there has to be like a consent like thing.
It's definitely not legal, but it drives me crazy. And I've had it with people who are like just not even in the same realm of what I do. Like it's just like, here's my personal thoughts on it. I'm like, I don't care about that at all. But anyway, I just wanted to say that.
That's okay. I'm glad you did.
So don't do that.
I will not. But no, I do hope that you write the book and that you get the information out there for us, because I think everyone's perspective matters, you know, especially if we're looking at it through lens of learning and not dogma. I hope we get more and more of that material out there explaining why we can embrace the nuance, the mosaic, if you will, and you know, move from there, because the polarities are literally killing us.
Right.
So,
yeah. Well, I said it on the Leaving Eden podcast, you know, the perspective that's really been missing from public discourse has been that of the straight white male. So I really want to throw my hat in the ring because I think it's time that a guy that looks like me is represented in a media. So
yes, I love it. Sarcasm.
Let the record show she was muted, but she was laughing for anybody listening.
My dog was not making noise.
It was a joke. But anyway, well, for people who are listening, The Cheating Wife, which is not based on you, just to clarify, even when I title the episode, I'll have to keep that in mind. The Cheating Wife, it's the SEO on that is not great. But it comes out April 24th. For people who are wanting to check it out, last chance elevator pitch, why they should buy it and who should buy it and where can they buy it?
Well, you know, people who love fiction should buy it. And
it's broad.
Yes, it is broad. It is broad. So I'll bring it down. I'll narrow it down. It's really the target audience is for women, and hopefully women who have had any experience within a relationship where they have felt belittled or manipulated or controlled. I do, like I said, have the church plays a bit of a role in it. So if you're familiar with the Bible Belt or any type of coercive control within that environment, I think it'll resonate with you, and ultimately see how we can do better as a society to move past labeling people for their mistakes or even to quick judgments.
All right. Well, if you're listening to this, be sure to check the link in the show notes of this episode. Depending on when you're listening, you either have the option to join the launch team for the book, or if you're going back and listening to this a couple months down the road, there is a link to order the book directly in the show notes of this episode. I highly recommend anything Shelley does. I think it's your third time on the podcast, so I think that's a good indicator. I co-sign you as a person. So I hope people will check it out. And thank you so much for joining me on this episode. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Eric. It's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes. And don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.